Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. My guest today is a person who spans millennia, and all this through the medium of water. Let me explain. His interest is specifically what lies deep below Maltese waters, especially wrecks. Whether they are ancient or date to World War II, you can be sure he has either discovered them or knows all there is to know about them. He is a maritime archaeologist and an associate professor at the Department of Classics and Archaeology at the University of Malta. Now, our paths first crossed many years ago when he was working on a project that investigated the ancient cisterns of Mdina, and together with his international team, and by the way, one of whom had just recovered from a devastating and rare shark attack in foreign waters, well, they sent down an ROV into the ancient well at Palazzo Falson, and they took sonar recordings and footage of what had not been seen by the human eye in centuries. And this remains my guest's specialty, the use of cutting-edge technology to uncover the ancient, untouched secrets that lie beneath our waters, whether they're in wells in the center of the island or offshore in the deep waters of the Mediterranean. He has directed several underwater surveys, not only in Maltese waters, but also in Spain, Italy, Croatia, and other parts of the Mediterranean. But his passion remains the World War II period, and he has indulged it by discovering and exploring wrecks of submarines, ships, and aircraft from this time period. But perhaps his most exciting project to date is the ongoing excavation of the Phoenician shipwreck off Schlendi in Gozo, which is currently considered the oldest shipwreck in the central Mediterranean. Timmy Gambin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I can't tell you how happy I am to be here.
Tell me a bit about you growing up. Did the sea always feature strongly in your life?
Yes, it did. I grew up 98 Howard Street, Sliema, which is quite literally 200 meters away from the beach in Sliema. That's where I learned how to swim. That's where I learned how to fish. I didn't know that the sea held, you know, the secrets that today I know it holds. But I must say that it was always a fascinating place to me.
Timmy, you also went on to study history later on in life. In fact, your undergrad, for your undergrad, you read history. But then, what made you change tack and specialize in maritime archaeology at postgrad and doctoral level?
That's a good question. I studied as an evening student. It was the last time that the university ran BAs in the evening. Throughout my studies, I always seemed to be attracted to aspects related to maritime history. Then, towards the end of my studies, I began to realize that there was a serious missing piece of Malta's historical puzzle. And that piece was, what evidence do we have for all the maritime activity that, you know, the island must have witnessed, because the island has been inhabited off and on. How much of that activity is actually, you know, present on the seabed? And the more I looked, the more I realized that we didn't know. We didn't have an answer to that. There were attempts in the recent past, I mean, since the late 1950s. Olaf Golscher was actually one of the pioneers who tried to get the subject of underwater archaeology sort of into the mainstream, so to speak. You know, when I finished my studies, what did I have from an academic point of view? I had a BA, and I had a knowledge that underwater archaeology was underexplored. So it is that pushed me to. So what's the next step after a BA if you're interested in studying? It's a master's. So the next question would be, what are you going to do your master's in? Guided by this kind of void, this lack of information, then that is where I decided to sort of go travel to Bristol. This is obviously pre-EU day, so you know, it wasn't as easy as it is today. Although today, now with Brexit, we're back to square one. I decided to travel to Bristol and read for my master's in maritime archaeology and history.
Why Bristol in particular?
Why Bristol? First of all, it was coming from a history background, and those were five fantastic years with the Department of History. I felt that the master's in Bristol was an MA in maritime archaeology and history. So I wasn't going in for something sort of completely unknown. So the history bit came slightly easier for me. The archaeology bit, I had to learn from scratch. So, and then the second reason is the course at the time was run by a chap called Toby Parker, AJ Parker, who's one of the most charismatic and one of the most intelligent academics I've come across with and had discussions with. And him as an individual attracted me to study at Bristol.
Timmy, going away from the actual study of archaeology to the sort of more general practice, it seems to me that at present the cut-off time for maritime archaeology is the Second World War. Do you think we should revise this and bring it closer to our time? And I'll tell you why I'm asking you this, because Act 19 of 2019, which made amends to the 2002 Cultural Heritage Act, includes any cultural remains over 50 years old on the seabed as part of Malta's underwater cultural heritage. Now, I mean, 50 years ago is well after the Second World War, and can you give me instances of cultural remains that effectively date to the 1960s that require protection?
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. And in this case, I can sit here and very proudly share that the update that you just quoted, which the 50 years actually stems from the original Cultural Heritage Act in 2003. So the foresight was already there. We always had this 50-year limit. So if you imagine in 2003, 50 years before 2003, it was written into the law to protect objects from World War II, objects and sites from World War II straight away. Now, so in 2021, you said it, so things that are 50 years or older are early 60s, late 50s. We have, I wouldn't say a massive, but a very important concentration of Cold War sites which are underwater, including planes. Okay, so planes from, I mean, literally, last year we discovered the remains of a plane that crashed in 1958 with the loss of 12 people on board. It was carrying out exercises at night.
For espionage?
No. It was carrying out exercises to train personnel on submarine hunting. And,
was fully recorded, just went missing.
It just went missing at night. It was an Avro Shackleton. It was flying low because the sonar they had for detecting submarines was, you know, it was early days of this technology, so they had to fly quite low over the sea. This thing had a massive wingspan. You know, they were flying at night where you can't distinguish the sea from the, you know, you can't distinguish the horizon. The pilot, obviously, you know, poor chap, made a mistake, and they crashed and they all went missing. This brings me to another point, Francesca, especially for more recent remains. It's relevant to your question. Why? Because if you think that, you know, maybe one of the crew had a one-year-old child in 1958, that person is in his or her early 60s. So they would never know where their father, you know, crashed and died. So in a way, the exploration of these sites are important because they give closure.
In 2015, you were awarded the Medal of Merit for Polish Culture for your work on the discovery and exploration of a Polish Navy destroyer, which was lost off Malta in June 1942. Now, does the Polish nation have any sort of claim to that wreck?
Absolutely not. With regard to ownership, there's no denying that they have a claim on the memory that this site evokes. And that is something which is extremely close to our hearts. We have something very, very special coming up in April, which if we have time, I will go into detail. So, with regard to the Polish government, I would say no, they don't have a right to the site, neither do they have a right to the objects from the site. But it was so important to them that in 2017, we were asked to, we had found the bell, we had located the bell, you know, the bell is considered the soul of the ship, so to speak. The Polish authorities actually asked the Maltese government to recover the bell. Now, we did recover it. We went on a speaking tour all around Poland to speak about the discovery of the site, the recovery of the bell. We had a 3D print made of the bell because it was a speaking tour. It would have been too complex to carry around this sort of, when I say priceless, not from a monetary point of view, but can you imagine losing this bell that means so much to the Polish? The Polish had a very hard time in World War II. They were first sort of crushed by the Germans and then steamrolled over by communist Russia. So the few tales of heroics for the Poles are very, very important to them. We set up and put up a memorial in Upper Baraka with the list of the sailors that died. The bell is going to go. First of all, it was a massive project to recover the bell. Heritage Malta did a fantastic job on conservation and restoration, because that's another thing. You know, you can't simply bring up an object from underwater, dry it with a towel, and put it on display. There's a whole conservation process, and with metals, it becomes, you know, quite a complex. But you know, Heritage Malta did a great job, and eventually this bell will be displayed and take pride of place in one of our museums. So again, no, they do not have a claim, but yet it doesn't mean that because they don't have a claim, we don't cooperate with them, and we try and maximize the sort of commemoration of this incident. You know, what the Polish ship was doing in essence was accompanying a convoy to Malta in Operation Harpoon. The convoy was, yes, to deliver military hardware and supplies, but also to deliver food, you know, and these 13 men, young men, gave the ultimate sacrifice in helping deliver this convoy.
Timmy, you've described it as the best virtual museum you've never heard of. This is the Virtual Museum Underwater Malta, a fantastic website that provides clear information and interactive graphics about the wrecks that are sighted in our waters. I spent hours in the lead up to this podcast just going through it and just enjoying navigating literally on these wrecks. You're the initiator and the director of this virtual museum. What was the impetus for it, and why is it a museum?
In the traditional world of museums, you know, you can set up a museum in the front room of your house. You have a physical space, you have physical objects, you can set it up, you know, as long as you have all the right permits and everything's been acquired legally, then there's no problem, you know. So whether the museum is open for free or at, you know, with a ticket and so on, that's fine. However, when it comes to underwater cultural heritage, you simply can't do that. You can't, you know, open it up to the general public. Heritage Malta have opened up 15 sites to the diving public, but the diving public forms a very small ratio or percentage of the general public, and divers who can actually dive safely, technically beyond 50 meters, is an even smaller percentage of that small percentage. So, I mean, first of all, I consider myself lucky to be able to discover and explore you know, and enjoy these sites. But why should it be only me and my team? There should be absolutely no way that it is only for a chosen few. The concept was, Francesca, to take the site to the people rather than the people to the site. And in the course of our studies, we do all the work that you see going into the museum. We do it for scientific purposes, but now with the advent of the museum, we're also starting to say, maybe a video from this angle will look great for the general public. So now we're also creating content that's kind of museum specific. Thankfully, the Malta Tourism Authority saw the potential in this, potential for a number of reasons. One, let's say the technical diving community, anybody who wants to dive in Malta, you know, in Malta on these wrecks can look them up before, they can plan their dives, etc. Two, for people who are history buffs. You know, there are many people who are interested in World War II or World War I and so on. And then the added value. So some people may say, I'm visiting Malta. I came across this virtual museum. When I'm there, I'm going to visit the physical war museum. Okay? So there are certain benefits sort of that go beyond our shores and internationally. You referred to it, or you bounced back to how I had described it in a recent conversation between us as the best virtual museum you've never heard of. We've created this beautiful and informative website. We're keeping it relevant. We're now, as I'm speaking here, there are people sort of elsewhere on the island who are working on adding another two sites. There'll be another two sites added by summer. As you know so well yourself, a museum needs to be kept alive, so we need to keep adding sites, we need to keep refreshing. The problem is now how to take a site like this from the few that know about it. When I say few, I mean, yes, we do get, 800-900 likes when we share, the fact that we've just uploaded a new site. But I honestly feel, and not because I'm involved, but I honestly believe that it is a great site, accessible to all levels. You know, if you have somebody, who's in his or her 60s or 70s, who can, navigate the internet in a normal way, then there is material for that person to see. If you have somebody younger or somebody being guided by a younger person, let's say, and they have access to VR goggles and so on, then you can actually put on the VR goggles and explore the site in virtual reality. So there's all, we're thinking of all levels. There's stuff from a variety of periods, from the Phoenician shipwreck to planes from the Cold War. So there's something for everyone, I suspect. Our next challenge is to get this to a global audience.
Absolutely. Now, one of the things I noticed, and this intrigued me, is that practically all the wrecks that form part of this virtual museum run along the northeast coast of Malta, and I couldn't see any, except for the Shilendi one, that face south or southwest of the island. Why is that? Is it the depth of the
island? No, it's simply because we have a large number of sites off the south coast of Malta. You have no doubt that range from a big concentration and variety of planes, because planes approaching Khalfar, for example, would have crashed off Filfla. We have a big concentration. To other types of shipwrecks that are datable to the 18th or early 19th century. One particular is absolutely fantastic. They are in deep waters, yes. However, we've done the ones that are easiest and most practical. Mm-hmm. So that is why you see a concentration outside of the harbour, because it's much easier to get there by boat rather than go halfway around the island and back. But slowly but surely, we'll include them as well. That's a good observation, but it doesn't mean that there are no wrecks. However, we will never see the concentration, for example, of warships that we have in front of the harbors on the other side of the island. And there is a good explanation to that. It's, you know, I just remembered it, and it's very important. If you think of harbor mouths as zones of convergence, so if you're sailing from Alexandria to Malta, you can, in open sea, you can zigzag all you want to avoid submarines and so on. But at some point, you're going to have to converge to come into the Grand Harbor. And in that zone of convergence, now, the Germans and the Italians knew this, so where would they? It's no use laying your mines in some sort of godforsaken maritime space halfway between here and Egypt. So they laid the majority of their minefields on the approaches. And that's why you have a concentration of warships. There were more ships in that area and more dangers to shipping in that area.
Is there more to be found in our waters?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Look, most of our work concentrates on waters that are 50 meters or deeper. There, we have a whole strategy, and this is an informed decision. Why? Because the waters up to 50 meters are diveable and have been diveable since the 1950s, since the advent of the scuba tank. So we believe that anything to be, you know, that had to be discovered down to 50 meters has been discovered, or it's covered in Posidonia seagrass, alga.
Or silt, perhaps.
Posidonia grows down to 50 meters. Divers don't usually dive beyond 50 meters, so our strategy was to use our sonar equipment from 50 meters, you know, out to whatever depth we're able to. What we have not touched upon, and to me, it's something that future generations will do, and, you know, I really sort of wish them the best of luck, because the biggest treasures will be found in our harbors.
Absolutely.
Where we have literally meters and meters of sediment. Just to give you an example, and Fondazioni actually published an article of mine way back when, I think it was, you know, coming up to 20 years ago, either 2002 or 2003. It was an article about the excavation that me and a couple of students at the time carried out in Dockyard Creek, opposite the Maritime Museum. Just to give you an idea, we excavated a trench that measures 2 by 2 meters, and maybe we, let's say for ease of maths, we excavated 1.5, so that's 1.5 cubic meters of mud. If I got my maths wrong, it's now official that I'm not very good on maths on a podcast too. But in that 1.5 cubic meters of mud, okay, we excavated over 1,100 pieces of archaeology that range from, you know, clay, an assortment of clay tobacco pipes, dice made out of bone that is semi-worked, that, you know, you can obviously see how the process of making dice, remnants of food, fish bone, rabbit bone, cooking pots, braziers, plates, poor seafarers' plates, rich officers' plates, and we excavated down to 1.6 meters and we reached about the 1550s. Now, it's not to say that if we excavated another 1.5 meters, we would have reached the Byzantine period, because it could well be that the knights used this particular part of the Grand Harbor in that period, and in the Byzantine period it would have been another part. But when you consider, this is to me, I carried out this survey 20 years ago now, and when I state this fact, and it is fact because we have, you know, the scientific remote sensing data, when you consider that between Senglea and Birgu, from seabed, so there's 60 feet, so 20 meters approximately of sea,
God only knows, and maybe God doesn't know what is present in the you know, there's the Battle of Malta of 1283.
Absolutely.
In the, you know, yes, one of the major naval battles of the Middle Ages. We've got the remnants of the Janissary attack of 1565 that was repelled underneath Senglia, you know, with reports of many people drowning and so on. We've got the loss of the big cannon that the Turks had brought over for the great siege, and when they were loading in a hurry in Pieta, it fell into the water. There's no record of it being recovered. These are just from the night spirit for which we have documentation. There's the Grand Caracca, which was brought over from Rhodes, with the interlude in France, and then brought over here. It was already very old. This was actually a ship built in the late 1400s, captured by the knights, and then brought over to Malta. So when they travelled to Malta, it was one of the ships that came with them. It was berthed in Birgu, used as sleeping quarters for slaves. It was massive. It was used as the mint, the treasury, okay, because they had only just arrived. A slave boy committed arson, and so the ship was on fire. When you have a ship on fire, the main thing is to prevent it from touching or crashing into other ships, and then sort of with the fire spreading to other vessels. So they cut the moorings. The knights gave the order for cannon on St. Angelo to shoot at this ship, and this ship sunk in Dockyard Creek. Now, we have records of certain objects being recovered, but the ship itself, at the very least, the hull, so the structure of the ship, which is from a historic time, we probably know more about Roman shipbuilding than we know about Renaissance shipbuilding. Actually, we do. So there's that. And in Dockyard Creek. Now we're not talking about Marsanchet, we're not talking about Marsa.
St. Paul's Island, again, you know, the famous story of St. Paul.
But every bay, Meliha, there are at least two shipwrecks. You know, one was excavated by Anna Frost. We continued the excavation just under 10 years ago, you know, it's a third, fourth century AD. St. Paul's Bay, Mistra, you know, there are objects coming up all the time. Schlendi and Jar and Gozo, Marsalfon, all these harbors, they're literally full of objects in the sediments. The fact that they're trapped in sediments is even better, it's even juicier for archaeologists, because the sediments remove all oxygen, they create an anaerobic layer.
Perfectly preserved, so as well preserved from, as possible.
And this will also interest you. So from Dockyard Creek, we excavated leather shoes, you know, because organic materials survive in an anaerobic context. So it's not just the quantity, but the potential for quality of archaeology in our harbors is absolutely, spectacular.
Have you ever found human remains on a wreck site? I mean, I'm not talking about the occasional toot, but about more substantial remains. And what is the ethical approach here? Do you document them for the museum, for example, and leave them on site? Or are these brought up for proper burial?
There are different approaches by different countries with regard to human remains in relatively recent warships. So the British believe that humans that lost their lives on a warship are buried there. So that is a war grave, and it must be respected and treated as a grave, as a resting place for those young men that were lost on that ship. Even if, for example, you know, we know that some of the sailors jumped off and tried to swim to shore, but disappeared with the current. But the site on the seabed is still, you know, what links sort of their passing with you know, it is the event or the material remains of the event that is linked to the passing of these young men. Now, if it's a war grave, it doesn't mean that you can't visit it, just like the Commonwealth graves that we have in Malta. I believe that it would be disrespectful not to visit the Commonwealth graves, because that's a way to forget, and forgetting is a dangerous thing when it comes to history, I believe. And therefore, this is why morally we sincerely believe that the opening up of shipwrecks that are also war graves is a good thing, as long as it's managed and controlled.
Absolutely.
So nobody would dream, or hopefully nobody would dream, of going to visit a Commonwealth graveyard, like, for example, the beautiful one in Ta'ali, and letting their children, you know, use the tombstones as a climbing frame and so on. You go, you visit with decorum, with respect, you take your experience and you leave. And that's exactly what we hope, you know, our visitors do. The Americans, on the other hand, are different. They make a promise that, you know, no man should be left, no person should be left behind, and they have an active program run by a department called the DPAA, and they run missions throughout the world, recovering, you know, excavating archaeologically sort of terrestrial sites in Vietnam, Belgium for World War II, but also underwater. I can't go into much detail. We do have at least two American planes in our territorial waters. We are in touch with the DPAA. I'm very, very proud of that, because they believe in our work and in the quality of our work. And one day, hopefully in a future podcast, we'll be able to share more results. And I'll come to the event that we have planned for April, because it's very pertinent. On the 27th of April 1942, HMS Edge, which was part of the 10th Submarine Flotilla, left Malta for Alexandria. Malta had become too dangerous, too heavily bombed, and the powers that be asked the submarines to leave, sort of one by one. The last orders were to sail 70 degrees off St. Elmo's Light and then turn towards Alexandria. 3 days later, when she was meant to arrive, she never arrived. Fast forward to around 2016, the grandson of the commander of this submarine contacted us at university and said, you know, I believe my grandfather lost his life off Malta, and not somewhere in between Malta and Alexandria. Thinking back, you know, to the concentration of minefields and so on, would you help me find his vessel? So we planned, and then we had to postpone. To cut a long story short, in 2019, we ran a survey. We discovered the remains of his grandfather's submarine, and all 34 young men were lost on board. It was lost with all hands on deck. Oh no, inside the submarine, actually. There was a very well-known journalist. The daughter of Commander Tomkinson, so the grandson's mother, was 2 months old, or approximately, when this incident happened, and she's still alive. She's coming for the commemoration. We're unveiling a memorial at St. Elmo. And we have at least 40 relatives. The daughter of the journalist that was on board lives in Australia. We've just received news that hopefully she'll travel all the way to Malta to attend. This is what it means, you know, 80 years later, yes. Francesca, and these people, these, you know, relatives are all traveling here to commemorate the dead. Sealed inside this submarine, besides the 34 men, are all their belongings. And I'll give you quite a touching example. So the family has all the love letters written by this young man, very tall, very good looking, Commander Tomkinson, to his wife. His wife's love letters are in the submarine, because they weren't going out on patrol, they were leaving, so literally they took everything with them and were going to set up a base in Alexandria. So this submerged tomb, so to speak, the steel tomb, contains human remains. It has historic value because it's part of the history of, you know, submarine warfare in the Mediterranean, part of Malta's story in World War II, and so on. It's just loaded with memory, okay? Things like these letters, you know, this is just one person. There are 34 people there, and, you know, one's a commander, one's a stoker. But they're all humans, they're all important, their memories are all important. And this gives us sort of another level to our
yes,
work.
Yes.
We're diving to put down a memorial plaque on the site. We have a memorial that's going to be unveiled on the 27th at Fort St. Elmo, overlooking sort of the site where she sank. So we take this notion of war graves extremely seriously, and we feel that if we only did the scientific work, which is, you know, dive the site, record it in 3D, and then heritage manage it, we would be failing these young people who gave the, you know, who made the ultimate sacrifice in for a cause that they believed in.
It's wonderful to hear. I mean, there is a huge moral responsibility if you are to acknowledge it, and you do acknowledge it. So it's wonderful that you do this, and in a way you're giving closure to the families, and all of a sudden you have this kind of sealed tube of information.
But it's going to remain sealed.
You can't open it at all.
No, even if we could, we wouldn't, because first of all, that's the kind of guidance that we get from the British government, that unfortunately, other types of ships, you know, you're able to go inside, and it's called wreck penetration. You know, there are a couple of you know, there are a number of divers who kind of live for that kind of thing. We ban it from our sites. Thankfully, the submarine is closed. The hatches are closed. The only hole is the one caused by the explosion of the mine, you know, on its starboard side. But it will remain sealed.
Okay. Ooh, on that sobering note, let's take a break before we come back to discuss the find of the century.
This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, maritime archaeologist Professor Timmy Gambin.
We're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode, especially this one, which has so many links to archaeology. Timmy, you've described the Phoenician shipwreck of Schlendi in Gozo as one of the most intriguing recent archaeological discoveries in the central Mediterranean. Tell me about your role in this discovery, and why is it such an important discovery?
More than 20 years ago, we were curious to explore whether the site studied by John Wood and John Woods from the UK in the late 50s and early 60s of Schlendi continued into deep water. We had an inkling, we had a hint that it did, because in 1993, the then museums department, my friend and colleague Ruben Grima, was involved in that survey, had, you know, descended slightly deeper than they were diving in the 60s with a submarine, with a French team. And they came across sort of a large archaeological deposit. So what we wanted to do in this project, you know, which started in the late 90s, was to map the extent of this. We called it the deep water wreck. It's in about 105 meters of water. So we started slowly but surely using different technologies. Fast forward to 2007. We got a new piece of technological kit, available, and we decided to survey the whole extent of what I call Outer Schlendi Bay, you know, from the tower to Ras El Wardiya. And the idea was to literally, for once and for all, to delineate this deep water site, and today we call it the Tower Wreck. Why? Because the Phoenician site that we discovered in 2007 as part of this broader survey is actually in deeper waters than the Tower Wreck. So it became a bit confusing calling it the deep water site when the Phoenician shipwreck is actually deeper. So anyway, in this broad survey that we were doing on the outer reaches of Schlendi Bay, we came across a target, and this target turned out to be, for me, what was a sort of a life and career-changing moment, which it wasn't a career and life-changing moment at that time, because when you see the first sonar images, they're grainy, you just know you have something, you hope you have something special, and then you have to wait till you visit the site. And, you know, I think a year or two later, we had the robot, an ROV, a remote-operated vehicle, to deploy, and, you know, we took some good photos. I shared those photos with a couple of colleagues, and, you know, lo and behold, we had the Phoenician shipwreck on our hands. Besides being the oldest known shipwreck in the central Mediterranean so far, we are, the university's team is the first team to ever excavate at a depth beyond 100 meters.
Internationally.
Anywhere in the world.
So you've pioneered technology to be able to do this?
Let's say not technology, but we've pioneered methodologies, mm-hmm. you know, together with our dive safety officer, Dave Gratian, who's been absolutely great. We started diving the site in 2016. In 2016 and 2017, we were quite literally, you know, just exploring what worked, what didn't work, how much time, how much could we get done in the 12 minutes that we have on the site. Once we realized over those two seasons that we could work, we were refused funding. People just had, you know, they thought, listen, what you want to do is great, but we don't believe it can be done, which actually inspired us even more, to be quite honest. So in 2018, we started excavating. And if you see the records of our excavation, it's exactly like we're excavating in 20 meters of water, you know, with a few kind of changes and tweaks to equipment that we had to do on, not on the fly, that we had to plan for. And we excavated for four seasons. We planned to excavate an area 4 meters by two over four seasons, and everything that we said we set out to do, we did, and we did actually more. So we excavated, we finished in 2021, as was the plan, and we excavated the entire trench. Now we start to explore the objects and the stories that were brought up in these four seasons of excavation. So it's not, you know, our work isn't done.
We'll come to the finds soon. But I just wanted to highlight this. I went through your very, very informative site, because you have been putting up a lot of information. You didn't wait to, you know, for the final concluding report to then publish it with this information, and that's excellent. The site is called phoenicianshipwreck.org. On the site there's a lot of information about even the methodology, and I marveled at the difficulties your team faced. For example, it takes the divers 6 minutes to get down to 110 meters approximately. They can then only proceed to work on the wreck for a maximum of 14 minutes. You mentioned 12, 14, it's very little.
14 is the max.
And then it's 3 hours to decompress gradually until they can surface.
Yes.
So it's very, very little time. They have to be super organized, and you have to obviously have given them guidance as to what they must record or must lift off the site. We'll talk about that later. But in addition, down on the wreck site itself, at a depth of 110 meters, it must be pitch dark.
You've highlighted a number of difficulties, and each one merits sort of quite a detailed answer. But I'll try and be as brief as possible. With regard to the timing, there's no choice. So those are the times.
Limitation of the human body.
Those are the times. It's yes, as you rightly said, the limitations of the human body, the limitations of technology available today. Now, many people used to ask us, and maybe, you know, some still do, whether it was worth excavating when you only have 14 minutes. And now, looking back at the past four seasons, I say, you know, hell yes, it was worth excavating, because the amount of scientific information that we've recovered is huge. Two, we've also let's say, semi-paved the way for others who would like to attempt excavating, sort of, if not at this depth, maybe slightly shallower or slightly deeper. But at least, you know, we've published our methodologies, not just on the website, but also in important sort of academic journals, and people can sort of refer to our work and say, okay, these guys did it this way, we can modify their approach, and hopefully, you know, they'll be able to do it better and safer based on what we've done. So planning is a huge part. We have a daily briefing and debriefing. The archaeology and scientific part is done by myself. The diving part is done by the dive safety officer, Dave, because it's absolutely necessary to know exactly what your job is for those 14 minutes. You know, if you lose 1.4 minutes, that's 10% of your time. I must say, and I must thank, I'm not going to name them, but they're all there on the Phoenician shipwreck.org website. These people take time off their job. Most of them are volunteers. They take time of their work to come and work on this project. So they're pretty amazing people. We also have a fantastic surface support team, because a lot of the, you know, although we are sort of the divers or there are the technical divers, then we have an incredible Francesca support team. They dive down to 20 meters, they take our equipment, they give us reassurance. We know that they're like guardian angels, you know. We know that if we have a problem, that they're constantly there watching us. Then we've got, you know, the people on the boats and so on. Sometimes we're about 30 people, you know, in this project.
Timmy, have you been down on the site yourself?
Oh yes, since 2016, mm-hmm. I've spent hundreds of hours, sort of, not on the site, mm-hmm. because I only get 14 minutes, but you can't be a general and send your troops to war and sit in an armchair, you know, smoking a pipe. You have to, in essence, go to war with your troops. So there was no way that I would even have considered undertaking such a project, directing, you know, works from the surface. I don't dive every single time, because sometimes I'm needed on the surface, but very few people have done, you know, every single season, every single dive. But the simple answer is yes, of course, I participate in all the deep diving projects.
Let's talk about the finds, because the finds have been really interesting, apart from a human tooth, and that was the only human remain that was found. You found ceramics of a typology that was hitherto unknown. There were other ceramics which were very rare. You found querns from Pantelleria that shed light on trade routes of the time. Now, why do you believe the ship was leaving rather than arriving in Gozo?
Very simple answer. A colleague of mine from the University of Malta, Dr. Maxine Anastasi, is an expert on many things, and one of the things she's an expert on is the identification of clay. We know pottery is made from clay. The clay in Malta is different to the clay in Libya, which is different to the clay in Croatia, for example, because they have, you know, their own distinct characteristics. So, let's say clay in Sicily will probably have more volcanic inclusions than in Malta. And one of the studies that we did in this, what we call the post-excavation phase, is we sampled some of the objects that were brought up between 2014 and 2017, and we analyzed them. You create what are called thin sections, what are in essence slides. You know, if the younger generation remember what slides are. So there's slides with a profile of the clay. Maxine and Claudio Capelli look at these under a microscope, and they're very clever people, and therefore are able to identify where the clay was from. And there are some objects on the ship, you know, which are made from Maltese clay. When I say Maltese, I mean Maltese islands, you know, mm-hmm. Maltese and Gozenen.
So it must have taken them on board and was leaving. So coming probably from Pantelleria with the querns on board.
In the beginning, we believe that the ship was on a north south course. Why? Because it was carrying a type of amphora, so this clay container that we know from the island of Ischia. Imitations were also made in Sardinia, and this carried a very famous wine from Petikouse, from what is today the island of Ischia, just off the Bay of Naples. So we thought that, you know, the ship was sailing from the north, from the Tyrrhenian.
Hang on, you mentioned wine. Wine wasn't found in them, they weren't stopped with, and the wine was in.
No.
Are there deposits of wine?
But, that is one of the studies that we hope to execute in the near future. But when you look inside the amphora and you see them lined with pitch, they have a kind of black layer on the inside. That is highly indicative of the containers carrying wine. Why? Because the ancients would line the inside of the container with pitch so that the wine does not lose its taste, or even worse, sort of get some kind of sour taste from the reaction with the ceramic. So they would line it with pitch. Many of the amphorae were covered with pitch, so we can, you know, this very strong circumstantial evidence prove that they were carrying wine. We also had some people come over from Germany, and they took samples of the ceramics, because although you're lining it with pitch, over time, even over a short period of time, the ceramic will absorb some of the lipids, some of the fats of the contents. So you take experts took scrapings from inside the amphorae, they had them analyzed, and the indicators are that the amphorae were also carrying wine. So we have circumstantial evidence, we have scientific evidence, we haven't been as lucky to find, for example, as they have with some Roman shipwrecks, the remains of grape seeds and so on. So that's how we know they were carrying wine.
We must mention here, because perhaps we haven't highlighted this, that we did mention that it's a Phoenician shipwreck, but it dates to the 7th century BC. So we're looking at, well over 2 millennia.
Let's go beyond the actual objects themselves, and now project these objects, Francesca, into sort of the puzzle or the network of the central, actually of the entire Mediterranean. In the late 8th century BC, you have this massive movement of people moving out of the Balkan Peninsula and what is today Greece. They're going eastwards into the Black Sea, for example, but they're also going westwards, occupying places like Sicily, southern Italy. They found colonies in places like Marseille, Libya, close to Benghazi, Cyrenaica. We also have, at the same time, people moving out of the eastern Mediterranean from what is today Lebanon and Israel, the Phoenicians, and setting up colonies in places, you know, close to Tripoli, places like Leptismania, who was originally a Phoenician colony, Cadiz in Atlantic Spain, Malta, Carthage, Sardinia. So you've got this movement of people, and with a movement of people comes culture, comes knowledge, comes taste. So how much wine were people in the central Mediterranean drinking before the arrival of the Greeks and the Phoenicians? We don't really know. But what we do know is sort of with the arrival of the Greeks and the Phoenicians, wine drinking becomes not only very popular, but very, very much part of this ritualized process. So our shipwreck dates to a time, you know, 700 BC, maybe even slightly earlier, maybe 720 BC. You know, it's my co-director, Jean-Christophe Sorisot, you know, professor at University Aix-Marseille, he tends to be a bit more conservative and says 700. I'm a bit more pushy and say, I'd say, you know, maybe 720, 730. Whatever the case, it's from this period of movement of people. You know, just to give you an idea, prior to the arrival of the Phoenicians in Malta, the potters made made the containers, you know, by impastato. They would build up like with, for example, plasticine or Play-Doh. The Phoenicians got the, you know, brought the knowledge of the wheel. It's the same also with metalworks. We have some metals from the shipwreck, but we know that the Phoenicians made these incredible pieces of jewelry. They moved also jewelry from Egypt with its orientalizing style. We have found a very high-end Phoenician ceramic bowl. So let's say in the premier division of precious objects, there are these Phoenician silver bowls, you know, mentioned in Homer, not only given as a present, but and then handed down. And the story of its origin, that it was first brought by the Phoenician, is handed down with the object. But and then the second tier of importance are these same bowls replicated in clay. And we have one of these bowls. Again, they're not very common. It's a beautifully made bowl. Plus we have a mushroom lipped jug. You know, we had five before in all of Malta. Now we have seven, two from the shipwreck. So there were some high-end goods as well traveling on the ship. Plus, keep in mind that the objects that you and the listeners are able to explore through the website and through Google Arts and Culture, etc., those originate from 2 by 4 meters by about 1 meter deep. There is still at least 60 to 65% of the entire shipwreck still present there. So who knows whether there is a silver bowl? Because let's say we had no idea from what we were seeing on the top of the shipwreck that we were going to find cooking pots, that we were going to find a mushroom-lipped bowl, that we were going to find a fine Phoenician ceramic bowl, and so on. These things only came to light through excavation. So we don't know what's on the other 65%.
Timmy, is it a celebration every time you find something so spectacular?
Look, it is a massive satisfaction. I cannot deny that, and it's a massive satisfaction not just for me or my co-director of archaeology, Jean-Christophe, but it's a massive satisfaction for the entire team. I mean, quite literally, you know, to spend 14 minutes in a cloud of sediment excavating, and then 2.5 hours, you know, decompressing in the blue. For many days, just excavating, lowering the sediment. So when something like this comes to light, not only is it amazing, but it's also fantastic to see the reaction of the team. Mm-hmm. You know, one chap from Belgium is an air traffic controller, for example. And I mean, fantastic guy, fantastically intelligent, and yet to see, you know, sort of how keen he is and how excited he is to know more about the object. I think it makes it all worthwhile, not only for me, and obviously, you know, sharing this with the public, but also for these individuals.
Of course, it gives them fuel.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, we mentioned the human tooth. What's the latest information about it?
The human tooth is a huge find for a large number of reasons. First of all, it's extremely well preserved. Secondly, it's not common to find human remains on ancient shipwrecks. They're very far and few in between. I mentioned the fact that this shipwreck comes from a time when people were moving across the Mediterranean. So what we plan and then what we hope comes out of this plan is that we'll be able to extract DNA from the tooth, also do a carbon-14 date, you know, so remove some of the material from the tooth, some of the enamel, and send that for testing. And if we're able to extract ancient DNA, we're in advanced talks with some laboratories overseas. If we're able to extract DNA from this tooth, it will provide us with so much information.
Timmy, I have hundreds of other questions. Everything you say is making me, you know, is provoking other questions in my mind, but we're going to have to close off here. Can I just tell you thank you for your time, thank you for sharing your expertise, and more than anything, thank you for taking due consideration of the human side of things.
Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure, Francesca. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.